It's Ideasphere with environmental lawyer and vegetarian Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, defending beef.
It's interesting. There's this discussion that takes place in the United States often that presents meat as kind of an elite item and that poor people of the world don't have access to it. And if we want to feed the hungry of the world, we shouldn't be eating meat. Well, it's a strange way to present the issue because in reality, about 1 billion of the world's poorest people are dependent on livestock.
Livestock, especially cattle, are public enemy number one. That's been the perceived wisdom for decades. It's thought that they erode soils, pollute air and water, and damage riparian areas. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. 7 years ago, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization declared livestock to be the single largest contributor to human-generated climate change emissions. But environmental lawyer Nicolette Hahn-Nyman has an opposite opinion. She's also a rancher, vegetarian, and author of the book Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Her work is both a book about the big issues and ideas and the personal tale of a rancher. Her argument centers on the need to support smaller-scale farms, which she says should become the basis for the American food production. Ms. Hahn-Nyman, thanks so much for taking the time for this program.
I'm really happy to be here. Thank you.
A short time ago, I entered an interview with a doctor from the Utah Physicians who had a completely different stand on the position of beef in our diet. A number of things he brought up, you refute in very good fashion. So I want to take this time to have the opposition view, a case for sustainable meat production. You're a private farmer.
Right. We ran a ranch in Northern California, a grass-based ranch in Marin County.
With that, you have some particular methods you use to make sure your animals are not only cared for, but right up to the point of slaughter, they are absolutely a part of your family, if I can use that phrase.
Yeah, we believe very strongly that good animal husbandry is an essential part of raising animals for food. It not only ensures that the animal has a life that's worth living, which I think is really important. It's something that we owe all of the animals that are raised for food, but it creates healthier food. When you raise animals well and they don't have the stress, you don't have the stress hormones in their bodies, and you don't have any problems. You know, our own particular husbandry protocol is that we actually have someone, it's often my husband himself, who's present at the slaughterhouse for every animal's last moments and does all the animal handling himself. If it's not him, then it's our main cattle manager who does this. So it's always someone that is familiar to the animals. And we do that because we believe that we want to ensure that every animal is always humanely handled and that they don't experience anxiety or fear. I think those are the kinds of things that need to be done in food production to ensure that food is healthy and safe. And also that we are giving the animals their due, the respect that we owe them.
One of the things that comes into play here, and in your work you're trying to rectify this, is the difference between the raising of your cattle and the slaughterhouse. At this time, there are fewer and fewer slaughterhouses, and all of them are major corporations. Any violations that occur between your farm and the marketplace are most likely going to happen at the house.
Well, there is disappearing infrastructure. We used to have slaughterhouses around the United States located sort of in every region, and that was a really important step in the food chain. I have written an op-ed for the New York Times called Support Your Local Slaughterhouse, and that was basically after there was a beef recall north of where we live that affected many of the small farms and ranches here because it was really the only slaughterhouse that was within a close drive of those farms and ranches. So it's a really important part of the food chain. If we're going to have eggs in our food system, if we're going to have dairy, and if we're going to have meat, all of those animals. You have to have a place that is humane and safe and clean where those animals will go for the final stage of their life. What's been happening is that the slaughter industry in the United States has become increasingly consolidated. Many of those local places have been shut down. And that might make some people happy because they don't have slaughterhouses that they have to drive by in their communities. But it means that all of those animals have to be transported much longer distances. And it means that many farmers and ranchers in the United States today have no access at all to good, safe, healthy slaughterhouses. So this is a real problem. And many people in the sustainable food community, people that are trying to improve the food system, are trying to rectify this kind of hourglass situation that's happening. There's this little tiny narrow passageway that all farms and ranches have to go through to get their animals slaughtered. And increasingly, that little passageway is not available to smaller independent farms and ranches. So it's a very important issue.
One of the things you bring up in your work and spend a good deal of time on it is if we're going to look at a detrimental diet, we need to examine our overconsumption of sugar, especially high fructose corn syrup.
Sugar and grain-based foods are probably the primary culprits today. The second half of my book is all about the health issues. And I show that basically in the last few decades, and looking over the last century, our meat and dairy consumption has not changed all that much. Our beef consumption in the last three decades has gone down by 22%. Our overall red meat consumption has gone down by about 20%. These things people tend to think, animal fats and red meat especially, people tend to think these are the reasons we have so much hypertension, diabetes, and obesity in the United States. It absolutely is not the case because you simply have to look at the demographic data about consumption over the last few decades. What's much more credible is the argument that especially sugar and also other processed foods, we're getting 34% of our calories in the United States today from fast food. So we've really shifted the way we eat. We're eating far more sugar than we ever did. We're eating far more fast food. We're eating standing up and driving in our cars. You know, there are tons of things that have happened to sort of radically shift the way people are eating. These things do explain much of the rise of a lot of chronic diseases. But it's really not about animal fat and red meat, not at all the way people tend to assume.
You're right. It's one of the things that I'm very aware of. There are two things that we have increased in our diet dramatically. And if we read the labels, even on alcohol, more sugar is added and less alcohol in that specific case. But even our common diet has sugar. There's another factor there, too, and that's salt.
Yeah, salt is definitely another food additive. You know, it goes again to this whole idea of eating processed foods and eating fast food. Fast food is extremely salty. Any processed food, whether it's spaghetti sauce in a jar, whether it's breakfast cereal, whether it's salad dressing, these things have lots and lots of sugar and salt. In fact, there's research that specifically connects high fructose corn syrup, in fact, as well to a lot of the health problems. And high fructose corn syrup is probably the most problematic additive. There are people who want to claim that that's the problem, not sugar. I tend to think that both of those things are problematic and that high fructose corn syrup is worse. So I don't think it's just about the high fructose corn syrup, but there's pretty good evidence that shows basically your body cannot metabolize high fructose corn syrup. There's too much fructose in it and it really kind of affects your whole body's metabolism in a negative way. So we need to really re-examine the way we're eating in this country and get back to whole foods and real foods. Things that are simple and straightforward. The health research on meat, for example, when you look at the studies, there have literally been hundreds of studies about the health effects of red meat. And many of them have failed to differentiate between processed meats and fresh meat. But among those that have made that distinction, there was a huge study in Europe a few years ago, and there was also a large study done by the Harvard School of Public Health a few years ago that differentiated between processed meat and fresh meat. And they found that there was absolutely no health connection at all to the major health concerns with fresh meat. It's really about the processed meats. And so many of the studies that seem to suggest that red meat is unhealthy are really studies that didn't make the distinction between processed meats and fresh meat. And when the studies did make that distinction, they did find health problems connected with processed meats, but they found no connection at all to fresh meat.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with author, lawyer, and rancher Nicolette Hahn Nyman. The book is Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production, and subtitled The Manifesto of an Environmental Lawyer and Vegetarian Turned Cattle Rancher, Nicolette Hahn Nyman. You have a website, blog, or anything else you'd recommend for folks to check out?
I do have a website where I have a lot of my writings posted, and that is just NicoletteHahnNyman.com. I also have a Facebook page for the Defending Beef book. It's just Defending Beef on Facebook. And that Facebook page is kind of a treasure trove of lots of ecological and health articles and data that we've been putting there. It's not just stuff about the book. So it's a really interesting place to go for people that are Facebook users.
Okay, I will have that information posted at Public Radio Exchange, where this program can be heard in its entirety. You can also go to National Public Radio's homepage, npr.org, and check it out under podcasts. That's Defending Beef, Nicolette Hahn Nyman. I want to return to the health of the cattle themselves. One of the issues that we face is the mega industry that is now controlling the beef industry. Now, the challenge is we should be eating beef that is grass-fed, grazed as you do, and provided in a healthful manner for the consumers. However, the industry is controlled by the mega giants. How do we change that?
Yeah, it's true that the whole meat industry has gotten much more consolidated. I mean, the whole food industry, frankly, really all food, this is true. It's gotten much more consolidated and concentrated. This has many effects on the ecology of the way food is produced and on the healthfulness of the way food is produced. You know, Marion Nestle, who's written lots of books about the food system, repeatedly emphasizes in her books that the food industry, in order to make money, really has to create processed foods. And so when you just start thinking about the economics of it a little bit, it shows how problematic it is as far as the food industry needs the foods to be more and more processed in order to make more and more profit. Whereas human health, there's more and more evidence that the less processed it is and the less processed foods we eat, the healthier we are. So the motivations are kind of diametrically opposed to each other. My argument on cattle and on beef is that optimally, the cattle are always on grass. All the cattle in the United States are on grass at the beginning of their lives. The mother cows are on grass, the calves are on grass, the bulls are on grass. You know, the beginning of the life cycle for beef cattle is on grass. So that's one point I want to make that is very important. I'm not strictly talking about ranches that are doing grass-fed beef all the way through to the finishing stage. That is what we do on our ranch, and I think that's the optimal thing. But there are many excellent ranches that I've been on all over the United States where they raise their cattle entirely on grass. From an ecological standpoint, that is very beneficial to the food system, even if those animals end up going into a feedlot. So I just want to make that point. I think that's really important. From a health and nutrition standpoint, it is optimal if the cattle are entirely on grass. There are higher levels of omega-3s, higher levels of many vitamins and other nutrients. And what I think is actually even more important is that the cattle that are raised entirely on grass almost always are raised without hormones, without any weird feed additives in their feed. And there are many that are really problematic in the feed system. And they're raised without other drugs like beta agonists, Zilmax, that kind of thing, which are used in a lot of feedlots. So if you want to make sure that your beef is really healthful and doesn't have any of those drugs and chemicals, you are definitely best served by getting the totally grass-fed beef.
I'd like you to take a minute. You're talking about grass-fed and the grazing of the cattle. Someone listening might say, but wait a minute, I've heard about overgrazing and how dangerous that is and how it's actually creating problems with rainforest.
Right.
But there's also an issue that needs to be addressed is exactly how, and you bring this into your work, the cattle are improving the soil through what you refer to as sequestration of carbon.
The overgrazing issue was something that we've heard about it for decades. And the way my research has convinced me, from what I've seen firsthand over the last decade on our ranch and on other ranches around the United States, my research has really convinced me that this is not so much a question of overgrazing as much as it is, in many cases, a question of grazing that is not well managed. So when cattle are well managed, they're very environmentally beneficial. They can not only sequester carbon into the soils, but they actually will create a more dense vegetative cover. There's research out of University of North Dakota that showed that you can have up to 45% more vegetative growth on grazed grasslands than on ungrazed grasslands, because the presence of cattle actually stimulates the growth of the plants. So when cattle are well managed, their pruning through their grazing stimulates the growth of the plants. It actually creates far more diverse plant communities because the plants that start growing later in the season have an opportunity to get the sunlight and they have the space to grow, basically. So there's very good research on that, shows that when you have well-managed grazing, you have much more diverse plant communities. And then you have much healthier below-ground environments in the soils. And the soils, it turns out, are incredibly important for not just the health of plants that are coming out of there, but sort of all life depends on the soils, because you have more diverse plant growth and then you have more diverse animal life because of the fact that you have the plant growth that feeds many different forms of life above ground and below ground. So it turns out there are, you know, many, many downstream effects to having healthy soils. And there's quite a bit of research now that supports the conclusion that the grassland of the world are probably the most fertile opportunity for carbon sequestration in the soils. And carbon sequestration in the soils is where you're taking the carbon out of the atmosphere and you're getting essentially the plants to take it up and then to transfer it into the soils. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and the National Academies of Sciences have both agreed that probably 90% of the climate change mitigation that can occur in agriculture is in soil carbon sequestration. So there's a lot of excitement about this in the scientific community, and there's a lot of research going on around the world figuring out how best to do that. But the grasslands of the world are probably the physical environment where that carbon sequestration is most likely to take place, and grazing animals are essential to well-functioning grasslands.
The book is Defending Beef, The Case for Sustainable Meat Production. Author, rancher, vegetarian, and environmental lawyer, Nicolette Hahn Nyman. Check out our website at Nicolette Hahn Nyman, last name spelled H-A-H-N-N-I-M-A-N. This is Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with researcher and author Stephanie Westland. Her book, Field Exercises, How Veterans Are Healing Themselves Through Farming and Outdoor Activities. We were talking just a moment ago about animals in our lives, how important they are, and nature in general. Yet many of us overlook their importance. We've become isolated. Frequently we sit in front of the computers, as I'm doing now, spending time on our laptops and iPhones, ignoring activities around us. The terminals we relate to keep us preoccupied and distant from the outside world. I bring this up only because in your work, peace and conflict is what you specialize in, you're seeing some changes that have taken place in the way people relate to the environment. Perhaps we can take it just a step beyond and say, or ask, could this have relevance to our increased violence that's happening in this country?
Well, you know, that's actually a really interesting point, because in some ways that's how I came to do this research with veterans, is that I was first, as I was studying my coursework for my PhD in peace and conflict studies, I began to notice that the context of many turning points and changed relationships during peace processes. And so some of the examples that I looked at were the Oslo Accord. You'll remember that famous handshake on the White House lawn between Yes. Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin in 1993. Well, the negotiations that led up to that handshake were held in Norway by lower level officials. But they didn't spend time, you know, we typically think of peace negotiations as happening around a table in sort of this windowless room. But really, those negotiators spent a lot of time walking in the woods together, along lakes, at fjords. And really, the points when they had moments of change in their relationship, when they began to become more human to one another, these happened outside. And if you think about Camp David in Maryland, it's in the mountains, it's surrounded by trees. And there was, you know, the negotiations in the 1970s between Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. And a lot of those happened outdoors. They weren't happening in these, you know, quiet rooms. And so for me, while I was looking at that, that's when I also came to the veterans. And so I decided, because veterans are this, you know, often a marginalized population whose voices aren't heard, and I would like them to be heard, that's Yes. where I focus my research. But at the same time, if I was going to do another PhD, I would probably actually focus it on these other kind of conflict relationships.
I'd like to give you the opportunity to talk about any single experience you had in researching this book that you feel needs to be shared. We've talked about Christian and Nathan, but is there something specific that comes to mind that we shouldn't overlook?
I think the story of Chris Brown is really compelling. Christopher Brown was 22 when he came home from the Marines, and he had done two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And he was suffering the effects of post-traumatic stress disorder. And his counselor said, you know, why don't you try growing something? You know, the counselor was trying to help him figure out how to connect back into life and with himself and his community. And so what he ended up doing, he was living in an apartment at the time. And so he put this 1x2 foot garden box on his apartment balcony. And he decided to grow 4 plants. And I don't know what all 4 plants were, but one of them was mint. And for anyone who's ever grown mint, they probably can guess what happened to Chris's garden box. It got overtaken by the mint because it's invasive. And so this gave him really an interesting place, though. He talks about how it was a way to focus his thoughts and energies. So he was no longer focusing on his emotions and the difficulties that he was having, but he was starting to research, you know, what do plants need to grow and what could I do? And at the same time, he and his wife were drinking mint tea every day. And so then when they moved into a house with a backyard, he put in a 5x12 foot raised bed. And the thing that he said to me was, you know, each year I've been feeling better, or each year the garden's gotten better, and I've been able to produce more food out of it. And then each year I've been feeling better as far as my PTSD symptoms go too. And what Chris is doing today is he actually is the director of an organization called Growing Veterans, which is in Washington State. And they are growing food both for a community-supported agriculture program, but they're also basically working to get more veterans involved in farming and build this small network of farms that will hire veterans. And you know, he thinks he's really a proponent that growing food for other people and focusing on the sort of nurturing relationship of with plants and being able to have to serve communities in meaningful ways is a really important activity for veterans who are transitioning back to civilian life.
Let's close on the thought of biophilia and eco-psychology. It's critical to have the love of life. If we have that, we enjoy it.
Absolutely. And in eco-psychology in particular, it involves this idea that there's this ecological unconscious and that our, I love what Andy Fisher, who's an eco-psychologist and a psychotherapist, he says, you know, genuine sanity is grounded in the reality of the natural world. And the way he talks about it is when I was talking to him about some of the stories of the veterans that I had spoken with, he says, you know, that's very interesting because the body is capable of recognizing when it's in the presence of what it needs. And so he says, you know, when I'm hungry, my body's implying food. So you feel the pangs of hunger. And so what, and when someone is traumatized, the body then is implying these other, that it needs these other experiences to restore a sense of calm, of peace, and really of life. And so he looked at, you know, these veterans saying, I'm feeling better in these instances. And he says, you know, that's what their bodies, in a sense, are implying, that they need these experiences to complete their trauma experience, in a sense. In the chapter by Nathan Lewis in the book, he talks about how, you know, a lot of veterans are looking for opportunities to nurture. And I love what he says in terms of anything that provides that anchor into life is important. And that metaphor of an anchor into life can apply to any population, whether it's people living in a prison environment or older adults in a nursing home or children in schoolyards or really any of us coping with stress on a daily level, those kind of things.
Yes, what he calls the organism environmental field.
Right, that really one of the important things he talks about is that even for therapists, it actually might show that there's a benefit in stepping outside of the therapy room into a wider area, and that this might actually be very important in healing for any of us.
It's so important you've done this research, and I do admire what you've accomplished. And I thank you so very much for the time you've given us to express these ideas.
I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Field Exercises, How Veterans Are Healing Themselves Through Farming and Outdoor Activities, author Stephanie Westland. Check out our website at fieldexercises.com. If you have any thoughts, questions, suggestions, or comments about these broadcasts of Ideasphere, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.